WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Director Roland Jaffe has chosen to make movies about morally complex subjects, and he shot them on location in physically challenging conditions. His film, The Killing Fields, described the mass slaughter of Cambodians under the Pol Pot regime. He shot the film in Thailand, where he replicated the mass graves. His film, The Mission, starred Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons as missionaries converting Indians in Latin America. It was shot in the jungle and on rivers with staggering waterfalls. Jaffe's new film, City of Joy, is set in the slums of Calcutta. It's based on a best-selling novel by Dominic Lacpierre. The film stars Patrick Swayze as an American doctor who loses his confidence after he loses a patient. He goes to India in search of spiritual guidance, but through a series of mishaps and coincidences, ends up working at a free clinic in Calcutta. The film was shot in Calcutta and features several prominent Indian actors. I asked Roland Jaffe why he's made films that take him far from home to developing countries.
It's a coincidence, but then, of course, when you look at any coincidence, you realize that there is a design to it. The rational reason, you know, the one that I kind of give in interviews like this, is that I say that basically it is the one problem we all have to come to terms with, is the cross-fertilization of cultures. If we don't learn how to do this, we don't enjoy doing this, if we don't make it into a growthful, beneficial thing to do, then we're going to face insurmountable problems. And therefore I make films, I think, that are about that. But also, maybe in some unconscious way, I should have been a travel agent. I feel that a wonderful thing that movies can do is to take people to parts of the world they would never normally go. That, you know, you go to the cinema and a movie will sweep you up and take you to a part of the world that normally would be beyond your reach and will give you experiences and a way of looking at life that will enrich you as an audience but won't endanger you.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading about some of the conflicts around the film. During the shooting in Calcutta, there were protests because some people didn't want the city shown as a hellhole. Some people resented having this expensive film made in their backyard about poverty. I understand the set was firebombed and production was sometimes shut down by protests. Is that right?
We had the Indians are very, very inventive people, and they're very political people, very highly politicized. And demonstrations in Calcutta are to a penny, or to a rupee, I should say. We were making this film, remember, during the Gulf War, and it was very extraordinary to be in a sort of less industrially developed country while this Gulf War was going on. And so that made us very high profile. I remember one day being out on the streets, and there was a procession marching on the American embassy, and I caught the eye of a man in the crowd, and he looked at me and stopped for a second. Then he came over to me, and he said, "Today," he said, "we march on the American consulate, but tomorrow we will read in the American library." And then he gave me a great grin and disappeared back into the crowd. And that's important because Calcutta is rich and complex and everything is politicized, but it's also intensely human. And it's Marxist controlled, and it always amused me that here we were making a film about the party, about the people that the Marxist Party was supposed to represent, and they were objecting to it. The Indian technique is to create a kind of political furore in the hope that the political furore itself will prevent any real discussion happening about something that they would like to prevent. But basically, the Calcuttans gave us an enormously good welcome. And in one bustee we were in, the man said, "You know, you've come from 6,000 miles away to make a film here. We have politicians who don't even come 6 feet to visit us."
I was wondering if you ever went through some soul-searching during the shoot in Calcutta, thinking that here you were trying to make a socially relevant film about the poor of Calcutta, when at the same time some of the people of Calcutta saw the film as being the oppressor in a way, you know, rich movie coming in.
I know exactly what you're saying. And I won't say I soul-searched about it. I thought about it before I ever went and made the movie there. But you know, you couldn't take this seriously. The technique that Calcuttans use to block any apparent criticism of their city, though this film isn't critical of the city at all, is to create this kind of furore. They did it with Gunter Grass, who came to Calcutta and wrote a book called Stick Out Your Tongue. And the Calcuttans were furious about this book and started saying again, you know, this was oppression, this was capitalist oppression. They did it with Louis Malle when he made a film. They did it with Dominic Lapierre's book. They did it with Geoffrey Moorhouse when he wrote a book. Bengalis are very, very defensive. Now, that's probably, in a way, could be fair until you understand who are the people who are being defensive. The only people who are being defensive are basically government ministers. The people of Calcutta itself aren't defensive at all. They live in that city. They love that city. They cope with that city. And they knew that we were making a film that honors their spirit. You see, this isn't a film about the poor. This is a film about people.
What were some of the difficulties of shooting in Calcutta, which, from what I know and from what you've shown in your movie, is a very crowded city, very narrow streets?
Well, there are the usual ones. I guess more than anything, you know, the Indians are insatiably curious. Magnificently curious. And here we were with Om Puri and Shabana Azmi, who are two wonderful actors and who are as famous in Calcutta, I guess, as if we were walking down a New York street with, Madonna and Robert De Niro. You know, the crowd would build up, and crowds in India are crowds. I mean, at one point we had about 10 or 11,000 people watching the movie. The problem was, when we allowed our extras onto the set, you know, to be the people we were working with, the crowd thought could see no difference between them and the extras. So they thought everybody was being allowed on the set, and suddenly one would discover that this carefully orchestrated scene with maybe 3,000 people now had 13,000 people in, all of whom wanted to crowd around the leading actors to ask for their autograph. The streets are narrow and they're crowded, and one has to be very careful of that. But at the same time, we found almost everywhere we went, the most extraordinary sense of welcome. I mean, I remember one house we were in, and I was looking at this house, see if it was possible to shoot, and an old man came out and asked what we were doing, and I explained that we were making a film, and that we were considering using his house. What did he feel about that? And he looked at me for a long time, and he said, "Which studio?" And I said, "Well, I think it'll be Warner Brothers," which it was at that time. And there was a long pause, and he said, "I personally like Columbia." So, you know, the city is constantly surprising, and it's a wonderfully educated city. Like all cities, it thinks it's the center of the earth, and of course it isn't. But it's constantly surprising and constantly vivid, and as Max says in the film, there is something about that city that makes you feel more human and more alive, and that's what I wanted to honor in this picture.
There are a lot of lepers in the movie. Did you cast people who actually have leprosy?
Yes, we did. I went and visited Titigar leper colony, which is run by some priests and Mother Teresa. And that was a very, very moving experience. I was terrified when I went. I didn't realize how frightened I was until I got offered a cup of tea and found myself literally hesitating when I drank it. Well, nobody's ever got leprosy from a cup of tea, but this is what I had to surmount. But by the time I'd finished my visit, and I'd looked at the people, not at the leper, not at the disease, so to speak. And I realized something very, very important, which was that these were people suffering from a disease that is actually curable. But what is really causing their agony is people's fear of them, not the disease itself. And at that point, I determined that they should have a voice in the film. And we have a real rickshaw puller in the film. And I thought, you know, we should have some. There are some lepers. And I asked them whether they'd like to act in a movie. And they looked a bit shocked, but thought about it and then said, yes, they would. And they are in the movie. And the marvelous thing about the movie is that it's very warming, I think, and touching. But at the same time, since you're in contact with people, it's very strengthening, because you discover that, you know, disease, illness, muddle, poverty, whatever they are, cannot stand in the way of our understanding that we're dealing with people first, and these other attributes come second.
How contagious is leprosy?
Well, it's not really contagious at all. It's infectious, but not contagious. In other words, it doesn't kind of run from one person to another like influenza might. Only about 5% of the population actually can catch leprosy at all. It's a viral disease. And what it does is it attacks the nerves. And because you get loss of feeling in the nerves, if you're poor and uneducated and frightened, if you cut yourself, you don't feel it, so you can easily get gangrene. You might pick up something that's too hot and burn yourself without even knowing it. So the deformities that come with leprosy are actually it's not the body rotting, it's the result of maybe gangrene or an accident. But leprosy is absolutely curable. I mean, a course of, you know, 50 or 60 tablets, and the disease can be arrested and can be reversed.
Tell me why you cast Patrick Swayze as the American doctor who's given up on being a doctor and goes to India looking for some kind of spiritual guidance and instead finds that he really is a doctor.
Well, I think, you know, the idea of the magician who can no longer do magic, or as it then became in sort of Chekhov's plays, you know, the doctor who can't heal, is a very, very touching character. And I love the idea that he was a Westerner who's psychologically wounded, as many of us can be in the West, running away from life and discovering that the very act of running away has taken him into the most alive country in the world, which is India, and then into the most alive city in the world, for good or bad, which is Calcutta. And I've always felt that Patrick was a fine actor. I thought that in Dirty Dancing, I could see there a man who would take risks, but I also detected a real honesty in what he did and a lack of affectation. And I felt that for this part, what would have to happen is one would have to have an actor with whom the audience begin to identify, because he takes us through this wonderful story. But it would have to be somebody who was brave enough to be honest. And that's what I found Patrick was. When he came to interview me with me, he said, I'm terribly nervous about this, and I don't know whether I'm a good actor or not. It's not really for me to judge. All I will tell you is I will give you my heart. I will be totally honest, and I will be part of the community. And I really liked the way he said that. You know, he'd just done Ghost. This was a major star, and he didn't have to say these things. And when he said them, I felt the truth of them.
I know sometimes directors are given an A-list by the studio of actors who are bankable enough to star in this film. Did you get a list like that with his name on it?
No, absolutely not. In fact, in some ways, the studios took the reverse line. I mean, they said, hey, why are you taking such a risk? You know, go with a more established actor. You're going to have a lot of trouble with, you know, the critics, because they won't forgive him for the fact that, you know, he's been in some movies that they haven't approved of. And I think as a director, you know, I have to take risks. I've always tried to take risks with my movies, because you're doing it on behalf of the public. And I try to ignore, where it's sensible, conventional wisdom. And it was conventional wisdom saying, don't use Patrick.
Oh, I want to get to the question of paying extras. In all of your films in third world countries, The Killing Fields, The Mission, and City of Joy, this is something you had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
How is there some kind of like Hollywood Union scale that applies when you're working in the third world?
No, there isn't. And again, this is a case where one has to be intensely practical and not romantic. You know, the romantic view would be that we have to pay everybody, you know, the Hollywood scale. And of course, if you did that, you would unbalance things in the most terrible way. So what you have to do is you have to look at the average daily wage in the country, you know, what an extra would earn equivalently in America or in Europe, and then pay your Indian extras accordingly. There are unions in India. India's very, very heavily unionized. So we paid a little bit, you know, above the union rate, not so much as to cause embarrassment for other people, because you have to remember other films are being made, you know, other film units, Indian film units. So what you basically have to do is to look at the shape that the country gives you and learn to work with that.
When you say it would unbalance things if you paid a Hollywood wage in a third world country, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, imagine if you were an Indian filmmaker and an American movie arrived and suddenly paid people 50 times what you could pay to be them to be extras, your life would actually be made impossible. And, you know, you have to work with the rate of pay that people earn in the country. You can't just suddenly apply, because where do you stop? I mean, then do you give people health benefits? And did you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You have to work with the country. On the other hand, there are things you add, like we had our own unit doctors. And I think people working with us got a degree of medical attention that they hadn't had before.
My guest is Roland Jaffe. He directed the new film City of Joy, set in Calcutta. He also directed The Killing Fields and The Mission. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Film director Roland Jaffe is my guest. I want to get to one of your earlier films, The Killing Fields, which was about Sidney Shamberg of The New York Times, who was a reporter in Cambodia, and his relationship with Dith Pran, who got caught in Cambodia when Pol Pot took over.
Right.
How did you create the scenes of The Killing Fields, the scenes of piles of skeletons and bodies? There's some pretty gruesome footage in that film.
Well, I looked at an enormous number of photographs and was amazed and shocked at what I saw. But in a way, with movies, you don't recreate exactly what you see. What I try to do is I try to recreate what it feels like. So I wanted to recreate not a sort of documentary sense of those killing fields. I wanted to create what it looked like to Prahn, you know, what it... So I listened very carefully to things he was telling me. And then we just constructed images that I felt like him slipping into the pit and suddenly when he scrabbles around coming across something in the mud and then realizing little bit by little bit that there are bloated bodies in the water and things. That was done little bit by little bit to create in the audience the kind of emotions that Prahn was feeling. But those were actually made by a very, very skilled Thai doctor who makes skeletons out of artificial materials so people don't have to use, you know, real bones and buy real skeletons. And he worked with us and he made, you know, 80 or 90 of these things and bodies in various stages of decomposition, etc. We actually planted a lot of that stuff in a shrimp field that we'd hired from a lady, but somebody had forgotten to tell her to move out of the shrimp field. So I'm afraid the poor thing came out at 6 o'clock in the morning to collect her shrimps, not realizing that the film unit had been there sewing their picture, and walked straight into this absolute mayhem. And it took us a long time to calm her down and convince her that these things were just plastic.
It's been a few years since I saw The Killing Fields, but as I remember, there are scenes where Dithpran is starving to death.
Right.
And he eats insects because it's the only nourishment available.
Right.
How did you work that with Heng Noor, the actor?
Well, Heng, of course, had been through very similar experiences. In fact, we used to have some grisly but highly amusing conversations with Dithpran and Heng Noor, where they would both talk about what they had survived on. And, of course, as the conversation got fuller, they decided they'd survived on less. And we went from eating, you know, sort of land crabs until in the end people were eating the barks of trees. And it was very funny the way they were kind of topping one another in the horror of their diet. So nothing that we'd offer Heng to eat could be as bad as what he'd actually done. But of course, you know, we use plastic substitutes and things made up of food and, you know, we wouldn't expect him to go through that experience again. But again, you just listen to what people tell you and listen to those stories. And then in film terms, you find ways of reconstructing that using your imagination, but creating a reality which conveys itself to the audience, but which doesn't have to be real in front of the camera.
I'm sure you've seen Spalding Gray's monologue, which was both a show and a movie called Swimming to Cambodia, that was in part about making The Killing Fields, because he was cast as an American diplomat in the film.
Right.
And it was one of his first, or perhaps his very first, movie role. So did you see the monologue?
Yes, I did.
Was it fun for you, or was it aggravating to hear somebody else tell their side of the story, which might have been very different than yours?
Oh, no, it was tremendous. Spalding's very, very funny.
He is.
My real panic was that he would muddle up the description that he made of me. He said that I had the eyes of Rasputin, the body of Zorro, and the heart of Jesus, and I was just petrified he wouldn't get it all muddled up, because I'm not sure I wanted the heart of Zorro, the body of Jesus. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, well, I don't know if you've seen his new monologue, but in this one he describes having to narrate Swimming to Cambodia in the Soviet Union for people who are watching the film but don't understand English. Actually, it's translated by somebody else,
right.
You know, and the translator gets this all wrong, so I think in Russia your worst fears did come true.
Oh, don't. What agony.
In Swimming to Cambodia, Spalding tells the story of how he had to do one scene over and over and over again because he couldn't get his lines right. Mm-hmm. He's dyslexic and has trouble actually memorizing lines for a film. What's your memories of that scene?
Well, I think that's a pretty accurate record. The problem is I'm slightly dyslexic.
Are you really?
By the time Spalding had got his line wrong, and he said to me, he said, but was it 11 B-52s or was it 52 B-11s? And I said, Spalding, don't ask me a question like that. Now I'm getting confused. I had to go back to the script. By the time we'd finished, I wasn't sure whether there weren't 11 Spaldings and one bomber, or whether a bomber had dropped Spalding over the set. All I knew was it was taking a hell of a long time.
Did you know that he had dyslexia?
No, I didn't. But then I think people who have it very often don't know that they have it. All I know is I seem to have caught it from him.
Would you work with him again?
Yes. He's such an inventive man, and he was tremendous fun. And he was just as much fun off the set as he was on it. I mean, wherever there was a bit of mayhem going on in the set, somewhere in the middle of it, looking totally innocent, was Spalding. And I found that just delightful.
Your movie, The Mission, was set in South America, and it's I forget which country.
It was supposed to be in Argentina, mm-hmm. But we in fact shot it most of it in Colombia and a little bit in Argentina and Paraguay.
And the movie is about the impact of politics and religion and missionaries on Indians from the country. You invited Dan Berrigan down as a kind of spiritual advisor, you know, to get some sense of context for the missionaries.
Absolutely.
And in his journal, in Berrigan's journal, he mentioned as a kind of aside that Robert De Niro had 24 armed guards keeping watch outside his hotel room for insurance purposes. The insurance company was afraid that he might be abducted or held for ransom.
Right.
So did you know when you went down with him that the insurance company was going to require such extremes?
Well, yes. The thing is that we found a set, a wonderful location to build that mission. Set was absolutely lovely, and we started building it when we discovered there was one slight problem, which was that there was a trail that went through the middle of it, which seemed to be used once a week. And it turned out to be, well, the stories varied, either a cocaine trail or a marijuana trail.
What's marijuana?
Pot.
Oh.
So it was certainly a drug trail of one form or another, and that led us into some very curious negotiations because we couldn't abandon the set now we had it. And Colombia is that kind of country. And I think what happened with De Niro was that basically the idea was to assign 5 guards to him, but then the insurance company said, but how do we know that of the 5 guards, those 5 guards couldn't be bribed and would turn into the kidnappers? So they brought in something called DAS, which was a secret service thing. And the DAS guys, those 5 DAS, looked after the 5 guys who were the original guys. But then there was a rumor that DAS maybe was a little corrupt. So they brought in another 5 people who were DAS, but didn't tell them that they didn't tell the others they were DAS. So they thought they were another group. And, you know, by the time we'd finished, I think most of the cast probably were working for the Secret Service.
How did De Niro feel about this?
Well, I think that a lot of it, I think he only thought that he had 5. And I tried to encourage it in that way. There were 5 who kind of stayed pretty close to him. And I pretended the others were basically, you know, that a lot of people stand around in Colombia to hold up walls that might fall down or look after people if they feel faint in the street. And you know, I think Bob maybe began to feel that Colombia was full of lonely men who were out to kind of help other people if they were in trouble.
Roland Jaffe, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Roland Jaffe directed the new film City of Joy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.